комару. Ты душа любезный, совсем не под пару. Ты цветочка кроза родного Кавказа.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And you generous listeners out there who give us money every month, become patrons of the show, show us how much you appreciate with your money. We greatly appreciate it. We can't say thank you enough. So if you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/Eurasianknot and sign up and let us know how much you value the show and are willing to invest in it. So, Rusana, we actually got another sound submission.
That's amazing.
It really is. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not, but I'm not surprised. I'm just very excited to listen to it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm surprised just because, of course, thought this was a great idea, but I didn't know that we would get, you know, two submissions in 2 weeks. So it's really nice. So
maybe we finally have an initiative that clicks with people.
Yeah, maybe. So hopefully more people will send stuff in. So our sound for this week was submitted by Amanda through the Eurasian Knot's contact page. And I'll give the information on how you could submit a sound of your own after this. And let's listen to it. So this is the sound of the St. Petersburg Metro from 2024. So it was recorded sometime in the last 2 months. And it's the Metro stopping at Dostoevsky Station and getting ready to leave to Ligovsky Prospect Station. And Amanda says that by isolating the sound of the Metro and like removing kind of the visuals of being on the platform and seeing the car, you're able to hear the world the way futurist musicians were trying to hear it in the 1920s, the symphony of machinery, which I thought was a really cool thing to point out, right, to make this reference back to these futurists. She says the friction of the rails, the screeching of the brakes, the burst of air from the pneumatic brakes. And then you, of course, have the voice of the conductor telling passengers to be courteous and nice, to take their backpacks off. I want to pause on this backpack issue because I have this major problem on the bus. How students don't take their backpacks off drives me crazy.
Americans don't know how to use public transit.
They really don't. And I wish there was an announcement telling people to take them off. You know, take off your backpack so you don't hit another passenger who's kind of standing next to you. The audio also has a young woman who jokes with her friends that the conductor is about to announce that the doors are closing, which, of course, as always, he does. So I'm curious, what is your response to this sound and what Amanda has to say about it?
The metaphor that she's using, the symphony of machinery, is fascinating. And that's definitely the sound that artists and musicians back in the day were looking for, because there was so much fascination with the industrialization, right, at the beginning of the Soviet Union. This sound also made me miss Petersburg a lot.
Yes.
I used to live next to Dostoevsky Station at some point in my life. I also thought that this must have been recorded either early in the morning or late at night, because there isn't much of chatter, or just like the presence of humans is not as palpable.
Right, right.
It's very quiet. Like, you don't really hear much apart from the machinery and the announcer, the operator.
Yeah. I also have to say it does bring back a lot of nostalgia. But what really stood out to me, too, is how distinctive Russian metro trains sound from other metro trains. Now, I'm not saying that, say, the metro in D.C. sounds like other metros. I don't know. But it's a quintessential Russia sound for me. It's the sound that everybody who's been to one of the major cities and used the metro knows. So it was really nice to hear that. I really love her reference to the Symphony of Machinery, this effort to glorify the atmosphere, the environment of the working class by, you know, making music from machines and industrialization. And of course, it also harks back to one of my favorite musical groups, Einstürzende die Neubauten, which its music is made similar through the use of metal and machinery and other sounds to make music. So it really touched me in a variety of ways as well. Well, thank you, Amanda, for sharing this with us. And if you have a sound and you'd like to share it, please send it in. Send us something that has stuck with you. Record it like Amanda has, or send the links and point us to where we can find this sound. And you can submit your sounds at uranaut.org/contact. That's uranaut.org/contact. So I hope we get more submissions.
Me too.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so this week we have an interview with Maria Koskina, and this is an interview you set up, and you actually were the principal. So I don't know, would you like to say some things about it? And maybe I'll introduce her. We'll switch the roles here.
Sure. For a while, we've been trying to bring in more guests to talk about environmental issues in Russia, specifically environmental issues on the periphery, like not in Moscow, Petersburg, but like in faraway places. And when I was looking for someone who could fit the profile, a friend of mine pointed me to Maria, and I was so excited because the topic of her research is so fascinating. She studies the history of the Krasnoyarsk Dam and Soviet environmental policies and the way that they had an impact on the present. We got a chance to talk about the air pollution in Krasnoyarsk that has been plaguing the city for the past 10 years. And she gave us a glimpse into what problems Siberians are facing today. And that was exciting for me. I was really excited to talk to her about it.
Yeah, great. Well, I hope listeners will enjoy it, and it does bring a lot of information that you wouldn't normally get, particularly about environmental conditions and damage and pollution. Maria Koskina is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Freiburg. She's currently involved in a project on the history of Soviet glaciology in Central Asia with a focus on Kazakhstan. And Maria's book project narrates the transformation of the Yenisei River under Soviet development and explores how Siberian nature itself influenced environmental relations and subjectivities. Here's Maria Koskina.
Well, Maria, let's start. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about the focus of your work on Soviet environmental history?
Thanks, Rosanna. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Maria Koskina. I am a postdoc at the University of Fribourg, Switzerland. I defended my dissertation on the history of hydroelectric development in Siberia last spring, and now I'm kind of switching from liquid to frozen water resources and starting a project on the history of Soviet glaciology in Central Asia. So overall, my interest lies between the history of industrialization and environmentalism in Soviet Siberia. And I'm particularly focused on the times of, I would say, industrial revolution that happened in Siberia during the Cold War, because this is the time when the Soviet leadership, we can say, turned to the East. Today, it kind of means a different thing because Russia is splitting its ties with the Western countries and goes to China and other Asian states. But back then, it meant that more natural resources in Siberia are being developed and explored, and more cities are being built, more industrial facilities. So this really interested me in what was really going on and how people experienced this kind of industrial revolution over there.
I'm not going to bore you with the recap of my dissertation, but like in a nutshell, I'm also working on this turn to the East. Mm-hmm. Since I'm an anthropologist, I talk about the contemporary moment. And I wonder, just out of curiosity, whether the language of освоение or the conquering of nature was present, and like, how was it exactly used in Soviet propaganda?
Absolutely. It was all about the conquest. And освоение was always the term that intrigued me so much because of this root of svoy, your own, and like how it has this dual connotation of development that kind of seems to be benign in a way, but also making something your own, which has the rhetoric of the conquest underlying there. And I really like to compare Soviet Siberia to space at the time, because the space is being conquered by spaceships. The first person is going into space for the first time, and Siberia is kind of similar because it's dark and cold and vast and empty. At least this is how it was seen by the Soviet leadership. So the conquest of space, the conquest of Siberia, the conquest of the Far East, as you have probably explored it too, are coinciding in this time period. For example, when I studied the Krasnoyarsk Dam, the visit of Yuri Gagarin was a big event at the construction site, and he came there and they gave him the spade, and he laid the first cubic meter of concrete or whatever and drove a gigantic truck and sort of tried to energize this mostly young, strong workers that were invited to the construction to conquer everything, really, from the ground in Siberia to the space.
It struck me that there's this repeated effort to conquer the Far East or Siberia. I'm remembering an episode I did on the conquering or the development in Siberia and in the 19th century. I mean, I don't know if you can answer this, but do you have a sense of this repeated conquering, and why do they need to continually conquer? And what does conquering, like a final conquering, mean? Because in some ways, it kind of seems like they're still trying to conquer the Far East.
They're always conquer. They keep conquering. And I really continue this line from not only 19th century, but further back, 17th century, when the city of Krasnoyarsk was founded in 1628, and rivers were always used as this thoroughfares of colonial conquest. If you look at this very, very famous maps, the choreographic atlas that Harvard has in their library, you can see the rivers in very thick blue, and they're completely out of scale. They're not that big in reality, but they show them as really big and important transportation routes that kind of helped colonizers to move through this wilderness, through empty places, and to reclaim them, to appropriate them too. And I draw this narrative arc from these times to the 19th century, when furs, gold, ivory, and wood were exploited on a large scale and sold for hard currencies abroad, and to the time when the Krasnoyarsk Dam and other large hydroelectric dams were built on the same rivers that actually remained very important meridional routes in the Soviet times and today. So I look at these things together and see how this rhetoric of conquest was continued during this really unbridled industrialization under Khrushchev and Brezhnev.
Yeah, and I mean, there's still the rhetoric of conquest today, like in the Far East. They're still trying to, yeah, conquer. And I mean, Sean, just to like play around with the question you asked, like, what does it look like when it's conquered?
I look at human nature relationships through the eyes of the workers themselves. And I see, for example, how this rhetoric of conquest builds an illusion of power in people, because sometimes they could feel powerless, obviously, being members of authoritarian or totalitarian state. But this kind of conquest of nature, being above natural laws, being stronger and more powerful than nature itself, especially if we're talking about Siberian nature, the mighty Yenisei River, one of the longest and one of the most voluminous rivers in the world. And we see how people are harnessing it like a horse, sort of. It amplifies people's own subjectivity, their own sense of power. In a way, it's an illusion, of course, because sometimes workers kind of see this connotation there where they actually identify with nature rather than seeing it as their enemy. So one of the lines that I really like to use in my work that I think speaks a lot to this is that workers would say that they're not actually conquering Yenisei, they're proposing it an alliance. So in a way, they're looking at the river like they're a comrade. And I think I will adopt this as the name of my future book, Comrade Yenisei. So they see it as their fellow worker in a way. But we can't be fooled by that too, because when they say we're proposing the river and the lions to work together, they also say like, well, we have to suffer, we have to go through hardship to get somewhere, to reach communism, to become a better country, to catch up with the United States in the Cold War. They say that the river, nature in general, also has to suffer and to make some sort of sacrifice for all of us to reach this higher stage of development.
Most people who've worked on industrialization, of course, focused on that, like the industrial output, that maybe even the working conditions, etc. But you're throwing the environment into this. What attracted you to doing something like environmental history?
It's a part of a personal story and a part of my professional development trajectory. So I was born in the city of Tula, which is a heavily industrialized city. Many people even outside of Tula and Russia in general might have heard about the metallurgical works centered in the city of Tula and the famous weapons factory as well. And this is really the industrial facility that used resources that came from somewhere else, specifically from the Urals. And this is the long history that kind of made me really interested in these relationships between the so-called periphery, which I don't really see as a periphery myself anymore, the places that give something to the nation in general and sort of help it build its economic assets, this kind of flow of natural resources from the margins to the center, which happens with Siberia in general too. And so my father himself worked at one of such metallurgical plants, and it really helped us to live through the 90s. And I feel like since I haven't experienced such a hardship that 90s are known for, exactly because my dad worked at this state enterprise as a simple worker. And so I could see how the plant fed us by giving my dad salary, but it also poisoned us in many ways, because you see the rain would go and you see this pollution and spots on the leaves of the things that we grew. And it's such an interesting dual relationships of love and hatred, of destruction and livelihoods, providing for our livelihoods. It always intrigued me, and I was always interested in Siberia. I've also learned about the instances of environmental abuse and social abuse, the appropriation of land and the destruction of basically traditional native economies in Siberia. And I think these things have to be central when we talk about environmental practice and Russian imperial and Soviet colonial missions. But they are still on the margins in our field. And my goal was always to bring them to the center and to face them.
I'm curious, like, the way you talked about the ideas of workers seeing the river as a comrade, right? It kind of falls into something that you mentioned in this article that you published, where you spoke of a Soviet red and green utopia. And I'm just curious, what is that and how do they relate to one another?
When I talk about green socialism, first of all, I mean all of the breakthroughs in environmental legislation that came with the birth of the Soviet Union, the initiatives that were brought by Lenin himself, starting with the decree on land when everything was nationalized, and it was a part of a bigger project of taking better care of the environment. In many ways, it was a rhetoric, it was a political tool, because Soviet leaders would always criticize the way Tsarist authorities has exploited the land or didn't exploit it, and also how they oppressed the indigenous people around the nation. They really made an effort with establishing nature reserves, for example, Stalby Nature Reserve, that is adjacent to the Krasnoyarsk Dam, was established in 1925. It was a protected area before, but now it was a state-protected area, and in all of the zapovedniki across the nation, all of the human activity was essentially forbidden, except for the scientific activity, of course. And if we talk about the period that I'm writing about, first of all, it's the return to the so-called Leninist attitudes towards nature. And here, of course, we can be fantasizing about all of these posters where Lenin is on a hike or fishing or he's hunting. And, you know, Khrushchev wants to get back to this kind of course, to Lenin's course, because at this time, Stalinist diversion from the right communist path was considered to be something that we have to break away from. And so we're returning to the Lenin's course, including the Leninist attitudes towards nature, towards the care about nature and its protection. But at the same time, there is this red utopia that is the complete opposite. And according to some of the writings of Marx himself, nature exists for people's use and their liberation too, because, you know, Marxist communist ideology is all about the liberation of oppressed people, of the workers, and nature, natural resources are exactly the thing that can help us reach this stage and liberate the proletariat. So it's kind of like a paradox, right? How is it red and green? And it also reminds me of some of the critique of environmentalists from the right wing when they talk about environmentalists as like watermelons who are green on the outside and red on the inside, because our way out of the climate crisis and environmental crisis, we can think that something along totalitarian lines could actually work and could be the only way out of this, because we should prohibit people from certain practices, like, I don't know, using plastic or eating red meat, etc. So this could be the only way out of the environmental crisis. But I think also with my work, I try to bring some sort of nuance and first of all show how these visions of modernity and environmentalism between the United States and the Soviet Union were similar very often. And I look up to very good researchers that have done a huge progress in this area, like Kate Brown or the Shiba DeMuth, who focused, for example, on the nuclear proliferation and the closed nuclear cities in the United States and the Soviet Union, or the hunting for whales in this region called Beringia. And they really show how there are similarities between the two. It's not only the capitalism that we can blame for the degradation of the environment. And so this red and the green utopia, I hope, can teach us not only about the Soviet environmental practices, but how we can understand modern environmentalism in general, its limitations and its possibilities in general.
Mm. Okay, well, finally, now we can move forward and talk about the environmental crisis that was caused by the erection of the Krasnoyarsk Dam. Just to let our listeners know, Krasnoyarsk has been on the news for the past several years, maybe like a decade, because of its infamous black skies. Maria, can you tell our listeners a bit more about this issue and maybe the origins of it?
Absolutely. So this is black sky, or Regime Черного Неба, is a winter phenomenon. The Yenisei after the construction of the Krasnoyarsk Dam has never freezed again. It's not really from its source to the delta in the Kara Sea, but it's still a really large unfrozen window that we can witness downstream from the Krasnoyarsk Dam. It stretches to around 100, 200 kilometers, so it's huge. And it just no longer freezes. It used to be frozen for around two-thirds of the year. Really, most of the time, the winters are really long in Siberia, but it's not frozen anymore. And I will explain why, but right now I will just outline what the consequences of this phenomenon are. So the river doesn't freeze anymore, and instead, because it's a little warmer than it used to be, it soars. The Russians say parit. So it produces fog, it evaporates instead of being frozen solid, encased in a thick layer of ice. So the river produces a huge amount of fog that turns into a smog because it mixes with all of the industrial pollution, with all of the exhaust from, first of all, the aluminum plant, the second largest aluminum plant in the world, Krasnoyarsk aluminum plant. It was built in 1964, so a little bit after the construction of the Krasnoyarsk Dam started. There are also many thermal power plants that burn coal. So all of this is mixing into a really, I would say, deadly, almost deadly air. I don't really know how to call it, a very deadly, dangerous mixture. It's dark, so you can't really see the sky, you can't see the sun, and it's all along the river, in the river valley. The river goes right through Krasnoyarsk, which is a city of more than 1 million residents today. So the issue is quite serious because so many people have trouble breathing, especially if they're immune compromised. It contributes to the rise of the rates of illness incidents in the city. So this is what the black sky really is. In the summer, it's a completely different problem because of the wildfires, of course. But these problems have nothing to do with each other. But it's very sad that the residents cannot really get a respite right from this dangerous air.
It sounds quite dystopic, I have to say. So how are people dealing with this? How are they addressing this problem at local residents?
The first thing that I noticed coming there in 2019, so it was before the pandemic, I actually saw people wearing masks for the first time there before the pandemic, and I didn't probably pay attention to that so much. But then the pandemic happened and everyone started wearing masks. And it's probably something that you can see in large Chinese cities too, but I didn't expect this in Krasnoyarsk when I just came there. And I think many of us have this illusion or dream, Edenic kind of like image of Siberia as something that is clean and is famous for its unadulterated nature, because, you know, there's such an expanse of nature and it is supposed to be wild and pure, but it's really not. And I think the problem in Soviet Siberia is also connected with the major challenges that colonizers experienced from the imperial times, which is the distances, the great distances, and the difficulty of transportation of people and materials. So unfortunately, when industrial facilities are built, they're really concentrated in a tight spot, right? So all of the things are together. All of the industrial plants with their heavy pollution are very close to each other. And it produces this notorious wastelands, places that seem to be uninhabitable. The residents do many things. Well, first of all, they try to protect themselves by wearing masks. There is an amazing community that I've been following called Nieba Community or Sky Community. And Igor Specht, an entrepreneur and eco-activist, is the administrator of this community. He's leader of this community. He builds special devices called Nyeba. They're very small and they're affordable. You can get them, you can put them on your window, and they are really monitoring the level of pollution in the urban air. So his mission is basically to help everyone to exercise their right to know what the quality of the air is that they're breathing. And not only that, but he gathers the data from all of the devices all around the city, and he publishes the results every day. So it's not only for the people who own these devices, but for everyone who has social media, they can always check this. And, you know, I've given a few interviews and kind of like tired saying, like, yesterday I saw it again, how he advises everyone to not even go outside, or at least not to exercise outside, or to stay at home if you are immune compromised, if you have breathing problems, if you're a child or an older person. And it happens more and more often, unfortunately. He just tells the whole city of more than 1 million people to stay inside, which is insane. So this is the kind of like a civic grassroots initiative that is quite inspiring, right? But there are other things that people do. They try to advocate for some of the state initiatives that are consistently postponed very much due to the corruption, because already the city authorities recognized the need for metro in Krasnoyarsk, because the city was growing very fast. It wasn't nearly as a million in the middle of the century, but now it's more than a million people there. It's a huge number, especially for Siberia. And so the metro had to be built there. In the 70s, there was already a general plan designed for the metro. Now they're promising it to start working in 2026. We'll see.
Wow.
So that's kind of like the state solution, the solution that's coming from the state to this is how we're going to deal with it. We're going to develop public transit and the smog will go away.
Right. The cars are a big issue, and they're going along the river, across the river all the time. Because if you look at Krasnoyarsk, half of it is on one side of the river, another half of it on the other side, and they have to connect. You know, people live and work in different neighborhoods. They have to be on the go constantly. There are more cars. It's a big problem for many Soviet cities, right? If you go to Almaty, the air is horrible as well. And you can really see how, you know, if you wake up early enough at like 6 or 7 a.m. and you go outside, you can see the mountains, you can see the sky, but as the day goes by, people go to work and you just don't see anything anymore. And probably a bigger problem is, I don't know how to say, gasification of Krasnoyarsk, because it's a city, which is another crazy paradox, right, that doesn't have a supply of gas. So they're just burning and burning fossil fuels, producing more smoke that mixes with the evaporating Yenisei River, and they cannot gasify it. Their plans, it's coming. We'll see.
Yeah, the problem with gas, it's like all over Siberia, all the way to Sakhalin. When I lived in Sakhalin, people were burning coal, even though Sakhalin is like one of the major producers of oil and gas in the nation.
Right, it always goes somewhere else.
Yeah, it always goes abroad.
I mean, this is where also this kind of like feud between periphery and Moscow comes into play, because Moscow is considered to be like a bloodsucker that sucks out all of the resources and human resources in a way as well, because it's all connected with the appropriation of indigenous land and resettlement of indigenous people as well.
Well, speaking of indigenous people and the impact of the dam on indigenous people, did the construction of the dam displace a lot of local people who lived in the area?
So here I have a question too. Who do we consider local people. This is a very interesting question when we talk about Siberian history. You know, Russians started coming there in the 17th century. Are they local? Are they indigenous? It's very complicated.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, as a Siberian native, but then I was like, well, maybe I should introduce myself as a Siberian settler.
Yes, it's so interesting and funny in a way. I'm very obsessed, of course, with Siberia, Divnogorsk, the Krasnoyarsk Dam. I'm very passionate about the hydroelectric dam. So I always watch the current news coming from Divnogorsk, the city that was constructed together with the Krasnoyarsk Dam. And there is this Indigenous Peoples Day that United Nations have established. And the local newspaper, Agni Yeniseya, the Lights of the Yenisei, which was the dam's newspaper, took these interviews a few years ago, and they interviewed two young boys in the streets of Divnogorsk, and they were asking them who they considered to be indigenous people in this area in the Yenisei River Valley. And without thinking too long, they just said that, you know, my dad built the Krasnoyarsk Dam, and I think the builders of the Krasnoyarsk Dam are the indigenous people here. And that was a very important moment for me in my research to realize how this act of nature transformation and conquest of nature really build these relationships of belonging, this feeling of possession of this land and this landscape and the space, and really gave a start to what Siberians think as their native and indigenous communities. So here is a very interesting gradation and very interesting spectrum that encompasses locals, settlers, colonizers, nomads, and this is a word that dam builders often use describing themselves when they had to live in like tents and dugouts and wagons. But of course, they were not indigenous people in any way, but they considered themselves.
Well, isn't this the magic of osvoyenie? You come to colonize and then you transform the territory and the territory becomes yours, but then also you yourself become someone different, right?
Yes, the whole project of industrialization, of transformation of nature is the way to make the space and the people Soviet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also curious, since we started talking about the dam again, and I keep coming back to your fascinating future book title, Comrade Yenisei, and I wonder, like, what was the image of the river, apart from the image of the comrade, what was it in Soviet propaganda when they were talking about the construction of the dam and just this area more generally?
So this is really my favorite part, and what helped me to be committed to this research for years and probably for years to come. The conquest of the Yenisei, the building of the dam, is a very spectacular thing. It's very cinemagenic. It's very photogenic. You can't really imagine anything more powerful than looking at people diverting the river. That is a huge river. It's a mighty river. It's very fast. It's very voluminous. And sort of like making it go through this artificial tube, or I don't know how to even call it. And at the same time, it allows the river to do its own thing. It's natural. It's an organic machine, as many American environmental historians call hydroelectric dams. It's a society-nature hybrid. But at the same time, it's something that is completely different. It's a creation of its own. And so there are so many movies that were made at the Krasnoyarsk Dam. It became a real Soviet Hollywood in a way. You would never think about it, but you really see how this becomes a symbol of nature's conquest, of development, of expansion of Soviet industry to the east. And this metaphor is powerful in itself, the harnessing of the river. And it probably resonated with people who have been peasants too, because you can imagine the river as a horse. I love this art piece that is in the hall of the Krasnoyarsk Dam. Nobody really knows the author, but it's the most powerful image because it shows a worker, a Soviet worker, a young, a very muscly, strong man, and there are two steeds, very muscly, three very muscly horses, and they're carrying a son in the carriage. It's Helios, you know, a mythical kind of like deity, the sun. The sun is really radiant, and you see the gigantic rays coming of it. And this worker is taming the sun. He's like holding it with his hands. And so the hydroelectric dam is compared to the sun, and the Soviets are proud of themselves creating a sun of their own because it's a colossal amount of energy that they're now harvesting from the river, and they don't even need the sun anymore because they have a sun of their own. They have a sea of their own. They built this Krasnoyarsk Sea, and they really want to call it a sea. They're adamant on calling it a sea rather than reservoir or lake, artificial lake, because, you know, now Soviet workers can go there for vacation rather than buying expensive tickets and go to the Black Sea, which not many of them can afford. But now that they have this Krasnoyarsk Sea of their own, the indigenous myth is appropriated to build this imagery of the Yenisei as well, because he is described as a powerful bogatyr. And I want to remind everyone that bogatyr is not originally a Russian image either. It's a Turkic warrior hero, and you can kind of like hear it in the name if you think about it, and it correlates with batyr or other names for heroic warriors in the Turkic folklore, even though, of course, Tri Bogatyrya is the most iconic Russian folklore. But this image of the Yenisei as a bogatyr comes from this Buryat myth about the Lake Baikal and his daughter Angara, how she fell in love with Yenisei and escaped from Baikal as one of the only rivers that flows out of the lake. There are 300 rivers that flow into Baikal, and only the Angara makes it out. And so there's the story that Angara fell in love with Yenisei, Bogatyr Yenisei, and she escaped to him.
The Yenisei runs north to south, right? Oh, it's south to north.
South to north. It starts around the border between Mongolia, Tuva, and Krasnoyarsk Krai, and goes all the way to the Kara Sea. And it's joined by the Angara near the city of Yeniseisk, which is like an even older city that was founded before Krasnoyarsk.
So this wasn't one of the rivers they tried to change the flow of.
But they never accomplished it. I mean, they never really did it.
It was not, but it was definitely a part of the project. And it's funny that you say that right now, because there is this imagery of this love story of the Angara and the Yenisei, and the Soviet writers, journalists would start imagining other love stories, and they were like, why the Yenisei wouldn't fall in love with Amudarya too in the Central Asia and would actually make it south to Central Asia to like save this arid area from desiccation, to bring its waters to the south rather than the north. And it also answers your question on the imagery. The rivers and nature in general in the Soviet Union was considered to be existing out of time, вне времени, to be timeless, which means that it doesn't really do anything. It doesn't really make any sense because it's not producing anything. And it should be modern and industrialized to align to human understanding of how time has to develop. There are stages of development, and if the river doesn't change, if it doesn't start producing something, it doesn't make any sense. It's just carrying waters to the Arctic, into the Kara Sea, and I mean, it's just tuniyadits, you know, it's not really working. And it has to be transformed in order to bring some sort of benefit to the people, to society.
This really intersects with something you said earlier about looking at Soviet and American kind of together and similar, because this is a very strong, like in the United States, this idea of taking nature and making it profitable, right? To make it produce something is a big ideology. I mean, this is the ideology they used against Native Americans. They don't harness nature for production. And it's interesting to me that here you have both in a state socialist and a capitalist ideologies, you have this similar ideology of like nature has to be used to produce. And if it's not used to produce, it's a waste. It's like you're wasting the opportunity or something.
Exactly. And I very often, without really thinking too much about it, say how the Soviets capitalized on the river. And then I think about it and I'm like, what? That's not really the kind of words that we are used to using when we talk about, you know, socialism and communist development.
Mm-hmm. So just to conclude, what does this very specific story of the Krasnoyarsk Dam tell us about industrialization and environmentalism in Soviet Siberia more generally, or perhaps like in the Soviet Union more generally?
First of all, with this story, I wanted to show how protection of nature and its harnessing, its conquest really went hand in hand. They were two sides of the same coin, basically. And I haven't really elaborated on this yet. A big part of the construction of the Krasnoyarsk Dam was the belief in hydroelectric energy as a clean energy, you know, because when you look at it, you don't really see how you're really harming or destroying the environment. The river stays the same. It's still flowing. It's following its course. Maybe in a way it's better because, you know, they built a whole new reservoir, and sometimes they even compare it to Lake Baikal. And I mean, how cool is that to make another Baikal? They juxtapose the production of hydroelectric energy to the image of smokestacks that produce this hazardous, dangerous smoke. And they build this whole model green socialist city of Divnogorsk that actually swapped coal burning facilities, coal burning heating to electric boilers. So they really made an effort of creating this twin projects of a hydroelectric dam, something that is supposed to be a renewable energy source, and a forest city that is harmonious with nature around it. There are also protected green areas around the Krasnoyarsk Dam where you cannot fish or hunt as much as you like. And there is also Stalby Nature Preserve adjacent to the Krasnoyarsk Dam, where workers come very often to hike. They pick flowers, they pick berries, they collect cedar cones all around. They live very close to nature. They create this bond with nature as well. So all of these relationships are so diverse, and they're horizontal at times because nature does factor into the development. It does shape the development. Workers suffer from the cold. They have to go through hardship. So nature is never really passive. The river attempts to bring the dam down with the floods that happen every single spring. So we have to really look not at unilateral, one-sided relationships of how the state or people act on nature, but also nature shapes people, the development, and the new communities. And here, exploitation and protection go hand in hand. In the Stolby Nature Reserve itself, you know, employees help with the project of wolves extermination all around this area because supposedly they're harming the national economy. So all of these things are together. And also, as I mentioned before, I tried to extend the narrative arc of the imperial colonial conquest to our days, you know, and this Far Eastern hectare that is a new kind of like Homestead Act
mentioned.
initiative. I knew that it would ring the bell with you.
Well, that's what my PhD is about.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes, and I also really tried to show Siberia as the center rather than periphery for several things. First of all, nature exploitation. Second of all, environmentalism. The rise of non-state environmental consciousness. And I really think that this NEBA devices, the grassroots monitoring of urban air quality, is also a part, in a way, of the Soviet legacy, you know, of people's passion to protect, to manage, to preserve. It's not just the reflection and, you know, like post-Soviet desire to like do something different. It's also a part of the Soviet legacy in many ways. And so I tried to also show the Siberia as a trump card in a way that the Soviet leadership used in the Cold War rivalry. There is a term, hydroelectric envy. So Krasnoyarsk Dam was an important prestige project for the Soviet Union to show the superiority of Soviet science and technology and Soviet people, how they can harness and overcome natural forces. And this prestige project is as important for domestic audiences as for the rest of the world, for the United States, and for so-called third countries and non-aligned nations who are also striving for economic development and might want to use Soviet expertise and Soviet equipment, invite Soviet dam builders to their places. Hydroelectric dam is probably the technology that is most often used on banknotes of many different nations, and Krasnoyarsk dam was on the 10 rubles. But if you look at a bunch of banknotes from the past, you see how hydroelectric dams became really symbols of national development and like participation in this global race for industrialization.
That was Maria Koskina. Maria Koskina is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Freiburg. She is currently involved in a project on the history of Soviet glaciology in Central Asia with a focus on Kazakhstan. Maria's book project narrates the transformation of the Yenisei River under Soviet development and explores how Siberian nature itself influenced environmental relations and subjectivities.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode was mixed and edited by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. If you need some audio done, please seek out Daniel's services. He does a really good job for us, and his turnaround time is actually quite excellent. We never have to wait on him. In many cases, he's waiting on us. So if you need some audio services, go to www.podcutsediting.com, and Daniel will give you your first edit for free. And as you know, the Eurasian Knots is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh and listeners like you. I won't go through the whole spiel on how you should become a patron, but you should. I'll just say that. And help us out by spreading the word about the podcast on social media. Send us your sounds. We'll play them and have a little discussion. We'd like to hear from you. So until next time, bye.
Bye. Утимий дурной ходит и точит кичалы, а потом ее трезим, чтоб не убежалы.